much. If there's two or three questions, we can take them now, and then we're going to have a short break.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Well, absolutely fascinating. I just thought I'd add the philosophical dimension where I don't know whether you said at the beginning that you mentioned something about identity.
Yes.
And I sort of felt that identity is actually very site-specific.
Yes.
And I lived in this country for a long time. And yet, in this country, I'm regarded as an Indian.
Yes.
And yet, when I go back to India, I'm regarded as a non-Indian.
Sure.
And I just wondered whether you've sort of looked at that as a dimension of your work.
Yeah, I think I mentioned in the beginning that there was this kind of particular strategy that I've used, which is a denial of many of these expectations from the artist, including expectations from artwork itself. But in general life, I'm happy to be called an Indian in India or elsewhere. I don't have a problem with it. It's just
that some of us who live here seem to have a problem with that.
No, I understand. I've lived in the U.S. for 3-4 years. I mean, I studied there, basically, but I grew up in India. It's a little complicated. My mother's Japanese, but she's lived in India. She grew up there. She didn't. I grew up there. She has lived there since I've been one. So she speaks better Hindi than many people I know. And we grew up in a small town, in an interesting small town called Simla, which is a British colonial capital. It's kind of wacky and interesting. So, I have a lot of kind of interesting memories of that. But I feel Indian in some ways and not in others, and it's not a... I don't think of identity in those specific national terms. So.
You don't think identity is site-specific? That's the question I'm getting at.
I'm sorry?
You don't think that identity is site-specific? That's what I'm getting at, really.
Well...
I sort of feel that I've lived
No, there, there are obviously elements, it depends on how you define identity. There is a great part of you that comes out of where you are, where you live, what kind of work you're able to do, even as an artist. So yes, in that sense, your identity as an artist is undeniably site-specific. But it's a question of whether you claim a certain identity that is on, that is stuck on top of where you are. That is what I find bothersome. Or at least I haven't found a way to deal with that yet, or I'm critical of that. So undeniably, a lot of my work comes out of where I live. I have to work with people. I work with a carpenter. It's like normal. But whether I claim a certain position or not is a different issue. And I'm happy that some people do. Some people who deal with, say, national politics, or who deal with particular issues of nationhood, or are necessarily bound to a certain identity position. But I'm not, because I deal with issues, and I use electricity as a kind of metaphor for that. That are located, but are not, but are also universal, but are also dealing with ideas and concepts that can be exchanged. And when we open the box of identity, or if we void, or if we leave it open, then other things can fall into it. But otherwise, you're too busy kind of protecting it in one sense. And these are simplifications. There are great artists who are nationalists as well. So there's no one way or the other.
Thank you.
Sorry, I don't want to keep people from tea, but just very quickly, you made me realize electricity is actually our true master. No other species is so dependent on electricity.
Right.
I just imagine if we have a power cut, we have no light, no sound, no video, no air conditioning.
Sure.
I'd also want to know what you mean by everything is contestable.
Yes. The title for that work is a provocation, right? If everything were to be contestable, that means that everything is free market. That means that the state in Singapore loses their power. So in this scenario, if everything were to be contestable, the church's own switch will never work at all, will not work at all, right? So I'm saying everything is contestable because a large number of commodity markets, etc., are leaning towards contestability, electrical sector reform, and so on. But to consider what would happen if everything becomes contestable, or in one sense a pure capitalist scenario, certain things that we take for granted, or we rely on, or have understood historically to come from certain sources, will no longer come from those sources. So that's just my. It was a provocation. The name. Everything is clearly not contestable because the state controls a lot of it. You know. Yeah.
Perhaps we should just have a shorter break. In 20 minutes, we should be back at 3:45. And thank you very much, Ashok. Yeah. Good afternoon, and welcome back for the last session of the symposium. I would like to introduce our last speaker, and after which we'll have a few questions, and then it will be followed by a panel discussion. The next speaker is Shai Heredia. Shai has been the festival director of Experimenta since 2003. Experimenta is India's first festival for experimental cinema, and during its existence, the festival has rapidly developed into a significant new venue for artist film and video internationally. Heredia holds an MA in documentary film from Goldsmith College in London and lives and works in Mumbai, where she is currently teaching film studies and producing and directing short films and videos. Please welcome Shai Heredia.
Well, actually, I don't live in Bombay anymore. I moved 2 months ago. Anyway, what I'm going to be doing is essentially mapping the growth of Experimenta over the past 4 years. And I'm going to try and highlight how the identity and the curatorial framework of the festival has evolved. Starting as a reaction to Bollywood, essentially, and then evolving, into a forum that continually looks to redefine film form and film genre. Through a juxtaposition of the Western avant-garde experimental film and radical, rarely seen Indian films made on the periphery of the mainstream film context in India. Further to this, in an attempt to redefine experimental film for an Indian context, I'd like to present two movements, one of which is Experimenta, I feel, and the other one was at Films Division. Two movements of critiquing film and actually looking at experimentation with the moving image with a more critical lens. And both these movements exist in Bombay. I will show a few clips during the next 45 minutes to illustrate some of these points. And I will conclude with talking about how difficult it is to actually make Experimenta happen every year. Okay. So, dealing with the coexistence of cosmopolitanism with extreme poverty, migrant identities, and the trauma of displacement are daily visual experiences for a Bombayite. The consciousness created by engaging daily with such harsh disparities is what distinguishes a Bombay soul from that of any other urban inhabitant. On the surface, this is my view, the city seems to offer opportunities to work things out, to make sense of the chaos. But in essence, I believe it functions on deep insecurities and fear, with people winging it almost at every level. It is this formlessness and fluidity that has inspired some of the most profound and eccentric art. Salman Rushdie's Midnight's Children, Chandra Barrett's film Dawn, were both created in this city. Today's Mumbai is a city that is hastily negotiating a nation's move towards hyper-capitalism, a term I like to use. By posing a challenge to the delicate balance of personal and public value systems, this transitory period has interestingly generated a spirit of hope, one that is ironically rooted in deep cynicism towards the idea of nationhood. This has created a more individualized energy to build new opportunities for change. And hope through cynicism represents the survivalist politics of Bombay and is at the very root of how and why Experimenta, India's first independent film festival for experimental cinema, was born here. The word film in Bombay, as we all know, is entirely defined through the aesthetic scale and economics established by the production context of Bollywood. Yet, it is this city that spawned two very small, extremely significant areas where experimentation with the moving image has been has actually made a rather significant difference to the context of film in Bombay. My personal interest in experimental ethnography took me to the Archives of Films Division, India, many years ago. And this, the Films Division, I don't know if those of you who were here yesterday, but Films Division is the, was the production and distribution wing of the government where for education film and newsreels were produced. And a lot of, and basically these were the films that we saw before the main film screening. So as I studied these visual representations of post-colonial socialist India, I encountered a collective of filmmakers who were deeply concerned with the possibilities of political change through experimentation with film. There were, I mean, when I looked at the catalog, there was a section that was experimental documentaries, and there were about, there was a list of very few films, but films like And I Make Short Films, Trip, Child on Chessboard, Claxplosion, I think some of these showed yesterday. These were, I mean, this was a time when there was a chief producer, Jean Bhavnagari, who was actually very significant to act as an individual to make this movement as important as it was. He encouraged people, he encouraged the filmmakers to explore found footage, montage, use time lapse, animation. And I'd just like to read out his perspective on this during this whole period. A quote of Jean Bhavnagari's. The blank canvas and the virgin, unexposed film are the same. On it, the maker of film paints not with brush and oil, but with light. Not only on space, but in time at his cutting bench. Not only with color, but also with sound. In this, in facing a problem and solving it, a problem of style and form and content, documentary making, again as other arts, calls for experiment and grows with experimentation. So during this period, you know, new filmic presentation methods were used, and he actually opened up the labs and, you know, stock and gave incredible access to these filmmakers to, this during this time, a lot of people from the film industry used to visit the sets of, used to visit Films Division because of the energy of what was happening there. I'd like to screen a film by Pramod Pathy, who is actually one of the leading filmmakers of this time. And I think that this film, at least to me, in many ways links the madness and eccentric and radical nature of Bombay to Films Division and to Experimenta. Can we show Trip? Hello? So unfortunately, actually, this Films Division movement was very short, very brief. There was a big issue with, you know, there were lots of other filmmakers at the time who felt that it was a waste of public money to have this kind of experimentation happen. And a lot of the filmmakers either, you know, left Films Division, stayed on as administrative staff, or just kind of left the country. Experimenta essentially started out, I think, as a kind of, clearly as a reaction to Bollywood, and for a desperate need at the time for an alternative space through which the aesthetics of film could be discussed, critiqued, and explored. The idea was essentially to look at new ways of reading film and evolving like a more critical kind of relationship to film in India. I'd like to just kind of give you some background on myself. Experimenta started in 2003. I have been born and brought up, educated entirely in Bombay. I was at Goldsmiths just for a year to do an MA. My exposure to Western experimental film was mainly through friends who were studying in the States or in Europe, through VHS tapes that they brought back with them. Interestingly, for those of you who know Michael Snow's film So Is This, which is text film, it's text and image film, which actually kind of breaks down ideas about narrative cinema. So is this was hugely important to me at the time. And I, now when I look back, I realize why, because you know, narrative is largely the context of the film form in India. So also in terms of, at the time, film festivals were mainly government-run. There was no real independent space, very very few film clubs, really. And this was pre, you know, the days of DVD. So what happened was, I mean, after I came back from, I mean, I was working on commercials and corporate videos and doing the industry thing before I went to Goldsmiths. I even worked on one Bollywood film, actually. But when I came back from Goldsmiths, it was just kind of the idea of not having access to work and not having a community that one could connect with. That really was the reason, like, was why, you know, this idea of Experimenta kind of began to take shape, you know, with me and a few of my friends. And I think what happened was the idea was to actually bring people together who in an almost kind of activist manner, you know, could participate in building a new space for film in Bombay. I mean, I keep saying this because you have to understand that Bollywood is just huge, you know. It's just, and when you live there, there is no, it's just, there isn't, I mean, at that time at least, there's no space to actually talk about or think about the moving image outside of the context of Bollywood. However, anyway, I'll talk about the art cinema movement and stuff later. So at the time, I read an article in Film Waves, actually, on Karen Mirza and Brad Butler, who were running the light reading series at the time, who run Nowhere, the Artist Lab now. And I very randomly kind of just shot off this email to them, asking them if they were interested to collaborate on this experimental film festival. And I think they equally randomly said yeah. And we met thereafter in London when I was here to shoot a corporate video. But and then we managed to, curated about 15 films, you know, seminal films, Peter Gidal, Joyce Wieland, Michael Snow, Len Lai, about 15 or 16 of these films and took them back to Bombay. I managed to get some money through Kodak and the British Council gave me the venue. We had about 400 people over 3 days. The reaction, it was hugely significant at the time. I don't know if some of you have seen Peter Gidal's Room film, which is essentially an exploration of a room, low light exploration. I mean, you know, it's all about the grain of the film and the stock. And I mean, there was someone who, and it's a 50-minute silent film. Lots of people left the screening, but there were still 100 people sitting there. And someone came to me after the screening and said, you know, this is what filmmaking is about. It's about the grain, it's about the texture. And this is someone who is experiencing experimental film for the first time. Also, there was Rashid Irani, who's a film critic, who came up to me saying that, you know, he's for 40 years he'd been waiting to see Michael Snow's Wavelength, you know, and he was so thankful for that. And there was this energy at the time at the festival. To me personally, I mean, I think that was one of the most special festivals, actually. There was an energy which was essentially about, you know, people understanding that their individual participation by just sitting in that room was about collective change, you know, on a larger level with film. It became rather obvious after that Experimenta had to continue. And so, therefore, it became really important as well for me to begin to understand the context of what is experimental film in India, which was the point at which I went to Films Division and discovered, well, not discovered, but kind of learned about these films myself. I also realized very quickly, actually, that the context of what is termed experimental film is very complex, very fragmented, and extremely difficult, therefore, to kind of put into like a defined genre. I mean, it isn't easily definable, really. So what I also had to address at the time was the National Film Development Corporation of India was significant in creating what was the art cinema, the parallel cinema movement, which you know, with filmmakers like Shyam Benegal, Mrinal Sen, etc., they were more celebrated at the time, and they were considered the art filmmakers. These were, I mean, in my view, these were essentially, you know, they were government-funded films. They were essentially propagandist on a certain level. They were considered art cinema because they were serious, because they dealt with social issues. They were the films that were set in rural areas, interestingly made by elite filmmakers from the city. But anyway, I mean, that's not really an issue that one can get into, because anyone actually working with film in India is coming from some context of privilege or the other. But in any case, the point I'm trying to make here is that these films did not, in my view, necessarily create a new syntax for film in India. They existed quite clearly as a reaction to Bollywood. They did kind of, you know, maybe not be as trivial, etc., and not have songs, etc., like they did. But I think in terms of narrative, in terms of image making, in terms of cinema, I know that actually, at least my generation of filmmakers, I think a lot of us feel that what Satyajit Ray and Hrithik Ghatak started as a context of the avant-garde, if one can use that term here, of a cinematic avant-garde, was quite destroyed by this art cinema movement. Because what happened is that after that, I think any kind of relationship to art cinema was looked at as something that was slow, was about rural areas, was about social issues, and there was no real actual engagement with the form of film or looking at it through another lens, maybe. However, there was, I mean, Mani Kaul, I think, who was a filmmaker who some of us might know here, was someone who actually did experiment with form in very, very interesting ways. His work was very conceptually very rooted in classical texts. And but then these films weren't accessible to anyone. Like, I mean, I myself have seen two Mani Kaul films, you know. They were traveled to the West a lot. They were in film festival circles. But we didn't really have access to any of this work. I, in fact, was trying to curate one of Mani Kaul's films for the Cinema Prayog program for Tuesday. And there's one print at the archives, and the archives is being difficult about giving it out. Anyway, so we've had to not show that film. But what I'm trying to say is that, therefore, there were one or two or three individuals who worked in isolation and made interesting work. However, there was no movement of art cinema or a movement that actually critically looked at studying film, you know, with a more kind of intellectual engagement. Anyway, so having discussed this, I mean, having kind of put this out there, I need to just say that, I mean, most of the filmmakers of the parallel or art cinema movement, really, like I said earlier, were working in opposition to Bollywood, but ironically, a lot of them are making Bollywood films now, or are in some way or the other connected to Bollywood. I think it's really extremely important to understand that for anyone growing up in India, the first and only exposure you really have to film is through Bollywood. We've all grown up with watching Bollywood films. That's the kind of moving image that we saw. It's only much later, as someone who's studying film, that I was told that, you know, these are films that you should see. These are serious films. If you want to actually consider yourself a serious filmmaker, you watch this. However, our relationship to the moving image has come through work that we saw in Bollywood. Of course, Bollywood has its issues, etc. But there is some extremely strong cinematic tools and cinematic kind of explorations that Bollywood has done. I mean, in my experience, I would say up to the 80s, really. But I think it's interesting that aesthetic is used to in a more kind of intellectual way to make work that is, you know, both intellectually stimulating and accessible. And when I say accessible, accessible doesn't necessarily mean being dumbed down or being ugly, you know. I'd like to kind of, to illustrate this, I'd like to show you a film by Kamal Swaroop. He was a filmmaker who at the time was kind of outside of this movement, but in it, but outside of it. I think because his work wasn't really obviously serious, I think it had this edge of being, you know, some kind of Bollywoodish aesthetic in it. But it has become a cult film. It is not available at all to really see. We're lucky I managed to somehow discover this VCD clip of the film. So I'm going to show you a clip of the film. The film hasn't been subtitled. And there's like very few prints of the film. There's like two prints or three prints of the film. But it interestingly kind of uses several genres of film and creates like a very local visual texture. It was made in Ajmer and Pushkar at the time. I'd like to just maybe read out the synopsis, actually, since it's what I'm going to show you is... Anyway, it was made in 1988. Om Darbadar is a... It's called Om Darbadar. Om Darbadar is a fantastical portrait of life in a mythical small town. The film tells the story of a young boy called Om in the period of his carefree adolescence and its harsh disillusionments. Om has a rather strange family. His father quits his government job to dedicate himself to astrology, and his older sister is dating a good-for-nothing. Om is involved in science, but is also attracted to magic and religion. Above all, it seems as if his only outstanding skill is his ability to hold his breath underwater for a long time. Okay, so I'm going to show you a clip of the film. It doesn't really need subtitles because it's a song. And I think it might just help give you a sense of some of the things that I've been talking about.
कि भैया ने मुझे पहले से ही प्लान किया था आप जब साइंस में थे मैं आर्ट्स में थी आपने मुझे सूचना केंद्र में गुंडों से बचाया था मेरी डेट ऑफ बर्थ
मुझे मालूम है थोड़ी देर में इंसान चांद पे चलने लगेगा
Yeah. Rani.
So that was Kamal Swaroop's Om Dar Badar. It's unfortunate that this film hasn't been subtitled because it's extremely special and has been hugely inspirational to many filmmakers of, well, today. So Om Dar Badar was shown at Experimenta 2004 along with other films, which were like Nina Shivdasani Ravshan's film called Chhatrabhang. These were films that, like I said earlier, were kind of made around the same time as this art cinema movement, but never really kind of brought into the space. So they were on the periphery of that. So these are the, some of the films that I showed. I also showed films by which looked at kind of cross-cultural approaches to experimentation with film, because just as a reflection of a lot of filmmakers from Bombay or from India who were traveling to the West making work there, or also diaspora filmmakers coming to Bombay and making work here. And some of these films are actually being shown this evening, so you should try and catch them. That year as well, I showed the work of Matthias Muller, which was kind of interesting because Matthias's work, you know, has a lot to do with AIDS and homosexuality. And that's when I kind of realized that what happened was in one of the earlier 2004 Experimenta, I went to the NGMA, which is the National Gallery of Modern Art, to ask if it would be possible to host Experimenta in their auditorium. I was told, however, that all the films would have to be censored, and that especially with these kind of experimental films, you know, there's nudity, was what I was told by the curator of a space that is the equivalent of, well, the Tate Modern. I didn't know whether to really laugh or to cry, but I kind of realized then that Experimenta would have to therefore kind of hide almost within these cultural spaces like the British Council, the Max Müller Bhavan, simply because we get diplomatic immunity, which is how I was allowed to show Matthias's work. Moving on. Experimenta 2005 was the first year that we actually got about 200 entries into the festival. It was really quite interesting for me because in terms of how experimental film is perceived across the country, or the idea of experimental film is perceived across the country, it became an anthropological exercise almost to kind of read these films and understand the various contexts that they were coming from all over the country. I was told, actually, that a lot of people were making films for Experimenta, you know, which became therefore an interesting way for me to kind of read this idea of what experimental film can and can't be. I'd like to show, I don't know if this thing is working though. Okay. I'd like to show a film, an entry called Wonderland by a girl called Sonia Singh. When I saw this film, it was sent to me as a film. She said that, you know, she didn't have the money to really make a film, but she really wanted to make some work. So she actually went back to an audiovisual medium, which was also the medium in which I first learned how to make film. And she sent me a PowerPoint presentation as an experimental film. I never showed Wonderland at Experimenta, but it was hugely significant to me in terms of dislocating any idea I had, or specific idea I had of what experimental film is. I'd like to share this presentation with you. It's quite interesting, actually. But anyway. Okay, so that's a personal film. It is. It was her poetry and her own photographs that she put together and made, with which she made this film. That's the first time it's been screened anywhere. I mean, actually, no, it's been screened at it was screened at a small festival in India, and I think she said it was screened at a Japan Media Arts Festival. Anyway, I thought I'd share the experience of Wonderland with you. I began to kind of also realize after viewing a lot of the entries for that year was that the looseness of experimental film is really quite, I mean, is related hugely to well, the diversity of cultural diversity of India, and therefore the several different languages that people speak, therefore the literature that people read, and therefore their engagement with film technology. I think these become very kind of, from the work that I have seen, because a lot of time there isn't much exposure to other work, so besides Bollywood, like I was saying, so it's a very kind of raw engagement with the technology of film. So in 2005, the idea was to address the experimental film genre by inviting Amrit Gangar to talk about cinema prayog, and Adolphus Mikus to come and talk about personal film, and therefore to quite clearly kind of juxtapose the two genres of film. And it became quite clear, actually, that experimental film is really, in India, is based in the context of cinema and not the visual arts. Which therefore it means that the way it's kind of read or engaged with is quite different. I think what happened was film. I mean, the film started with Phalke doing, you know, his topicals and his mythological films. Post that, I mean, access to technology was not as easy as it was in the West. So it was not like, you know, we had small format 16mm or Super 8 or access to work as individuals to be able to make smaller films. It was about 35mm, it was about scale and because of cost. And therefore at that point with socialism, it was the government space that actually promoted any kind of experimentation at the time. Or you had to actually be, a rich kind of Maharaja or someone with a lot of money to get access to these cameras and to get that work processed. So essentially because of 35mm, I think for individuals to actually have access to making work, it was extremely difficult. Also, film was not really looked at beyond a point as a medium of art in terms of a material way. It was kind of just the idea that it was for entertainment and for communication, which is, I think, also something that one can factor in as to why cinema has stayed quite separate from the visual art context. I'd also like to say here that because of disconnected communities, a lack of access to libraries and archives, and a lack of critical arts teaching, there is an openness of genre, and therefore everyone works in isolation almost, and can in many ways choose to reinvent the wheel, really, and make very kind of raw pieces and based on their own, you know, relationships to technology or their access to certain kinds of technology. Therefore, in contrast to the West, we do not have, well, the burden of the generic kind of Western avant-garde. It's a loose and free context. There is, it is because of a lack of access. It is because of a lack of libraries, etc. But it is extremely fragmented, therefore. Looking at the two areas of, understanding that cinema in India was basically coming from areas of fiction and documentary. I'd like to show, at Experimenta this year, actually, we looked at works that blur the lines between fact and fantasy and that kind of were almost prophetic pieces that looked at like socio-political transformation at the time, and therefore Bombay became crucial to the festival as something to be critiqued. I'd like to show a clip of a film called John and Jane by Oshim Aluwalia. This was a film that in many ways reflects a lot of the changes in the city, including a lot of the changes of a generation. It documents a certain, cultural ambiguity that is it's set in call centers, basically. It's about six characters working in a call center. And I want to focus on, it's a short piece, it's about 6 minutes, it's on one character, and I think the kind of transformation or the views that this character has to the city of Bombay and to his job in call centers is quite significant to what is happening in the city now. The film was shot 3 years ago. It took about 3 years to edit. It was on 35mm, but what I will show you is a DVD clip of that. Okay, so I just wanted to say at the end of the day that basically it has been extremely difficult to have Experimenta as a festival survive in Bombay. I think Bombay, for its character, etc., offers the opportunity to, offers every opportunity to do work that's interesting, etc., but to sustain something that's actually very critical or critically engaged with in a kind of more intellectual way, it's extremely difficult without having to actually, engage the scale and the economics of the city. I've been told many times that for funding Experimenta that, which are the film stars who are going to come and open the festival, and where is the market for these films, etc. So it is, and I think the compromise, Experimenta is not, as a festival, willing to make that compromise, willing to kind of engage the scale of Bollywood, the scale of the commercialism of the city. And therefore, it's unfortunate, but I think it's going to be difficult for the festival just to continue just to exist in Bombay. Since I moved to Bangalore, I'm going to try and, have the festival in Bangalore. And I think somehow I'm hoping that there will be more of a real valued perspective on art and film in smaller cities in India, because Bombay has become a lot about, the big bucks and how much money art can or can't generate. Okay, so can we show the clip of John and Jane? Okay, so that's it, and we can end with the clip and then whatever questions, but I think I've run out of time.
And indeed, in these afternoon's sessions as well, we had a few different mentions to this characteristic of the city. And I think it's very interesting the fact that there are different kind of contrasts, not just like poor and rich or corporate buildings and slums, as Raoul was telling us, but also contrast between like different expressions within the cultural industry itself. So for instance, Shai was telling us that experimental film does not really belong to the visual arts discourse. But in the same time, I was wondering if we could map or sort of try to establish whether this is a real condition of the city, whether the different arts or the different expressions of culture are not really in a single continuum. And I'd like to ask first to Ashok what he thinks, because I feel that his practice is very much into mixing different aspects of different disciplines. You're interested in architecture, you're interested in new technology, and indeed also you are interested in what seems to me as a sort of immaterial mapping of the urban environment, or at least mapping of some sort of immaterial structures that is at place within the built environment.
There's various, there's obviously various kinds of maps. The question I'm trying to ask in one sense is whether maps are good for you, whether they mean anything, whether they... So a lot of my work is of a kind of mapping which isn't necessarily a functional map in any design sense of the word.
It sort of makes something visible.
Right, or it attempts a kind of state of mind or behavior. There are maps in which people... It's like software map. You can map this room to this button, or you can map all those buttons to this chair, and so on. And these mappings are possible technically. So I'm looking at it at that level. And as these technologies kind of sit on the city, they become very intensely kind of contested zones. And the questions I'm trying to ask again and again are who controls these maps? Because the map, like the electrical map of this room, is perhaps more meaningful to our activity right now than its physical map. The physical map determines that we're all laid out here, but the electrical map determines whether we can see each other, whether you can hear me, whether all that equipment in the back is actually working or not. So there's all this, you know, invisible infrastructure that hides issues of control and access. So I'm interested in not necessarily just mapping them out, but making them appear in ways that are interesting. So I'm not interested in mapping in a conventional, in the way the word tends to be used, of a kind of functional.
Not functional maps.
Or an understanding of behavior as it already exists. I'm interested in kind of turning the map upside down or making holes in it or, you know, things like that. That's just my reaction to being in architecture school for too long.
And do you feel that in the city there's this separation between different disciplines and art forms? Do you feel there's more a continuum? Because in your work I can see there is a dialogue between architecture and visual
sure.
art.
Sure, I mean, I do have friends in the city who are architects, for example. But yeah, it's a very different practice from the major art practices, like the painting, for example. So yeah, it is discrete, but the city is big enough and kind of wild enough for that to exist. So that's, you know, a good thing. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily have to hang out with painters if I don't want to, or, you know. So, I mean, I don't have anything against, you know, all that. I don't have anything against the art market even. It's just a thing, you know. The city does allow all kinds of other arrangements, and I'm looking in a different area. I'm looking at kind of craft, but industrialized craft, like, you know, electrical decorations and early automation and ideas like that. So it's diverse enough to allow for these kind of practices.
And I would like to ask Shai something about this. I mean, do you perceive that there is this gap in the cultural landscape between the different disciplines? And also, I'm very sorry to hear that Experimenta will not be in Bombay, but perhaps it would be a good thing for Bangalore. I'm sure it will. And what could, if you see that there are gaps and that there are sort of shortfall of communication, what else could make that?
I think there are gaps in, like, when you look at this, the different disciplines or art contexts in more defined ways. There are gaps between the different, you know, constructed communities, actually. For example, like with Experimenta, maybe there were a handful of artists who've ever come to the festival, a handful of, you know, the art cinema filmmakers who've ever come to the festival. It's been actually people like engineers, lawyers, you know, people doing scientists, you know, it's a range of a whole lot. It's open to a whole lot of other people, and it's not, you know, until this year it was free to come to Experimenta. It was a free festival, so it opened itself out to several other communities, because I've always felt that there's very clear, you know, boundaries drawn between different communities, artists and art and culture communities. I don't know if this is so in other, like in Delhi, but in Bombay it seems to be the way of the city. Maybe it's changing, I don't know. I think, yeah.
And Raoul, what's your vision on this? And also, I was really interested in this idea that you, this sort of parallel that you drew between the art school and the city being an art school. And so if you push this this metaphor to the extreme consequences, in fact, is the city divided into different departments? and how much the city conditions the cultural production that is happening today?
I think it's a very interesting way of looking at it. And secondly, the whole idea of diversity, you know, my training is in social anthropology. Mm-hmm. So the whole idea of how do you look at the idea of diversity, how do you map cultural differences, inevitably moves into into the realm of mapping different kinds of practices. Ultimately, what is culture? cultural production is essentially linked to practices of art. That is pretty classical, but definitely very few anthropologists would question that. So in that context, there's a certain way in which, I think it's very useful to transcend an understanding of cultural diversity, you know, beyond notions of communities and ethnic differences, etc., but locate them in ideas of artistic practice. Mm-hmm. And I think cities like Bombay, which is often called the most cosmopolitan city in the country, I think the cosmopolitanism is precisely linked to those moments of diversity, which are also to do with its diverse artistic practices as well. So, while Shai did talk about that because Bollywood is so big, in a sense, it also creates impulses. But these have been around for a long time. You know, the very fact that you had other institutions like FD or NFDC, etc., these were spaces which, in a sense, acted like a counterpoint. And there was a parallel cinema movement as well. So I think the way I look at it, the idea of mapping the city, I think artistic practice is a very integral part of mapping, and diverse artistic practices. Mm-hmm. The fact is that, of course, I think what is troubles people from a certain ideological point of view is obviously the fact of commerce and how does commerce enter into the whole picture? How does it interfere, sometimes short circuit the whole process in terms of what exactly is artistic production? So I, mm-hmm. so I think that there are interesting ways of looking at it. I think what you have framed is a very, very fascinating way.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you. And can I just ask you another question, Shai? Is like what would be an ideal institution that you would want to see in Bombay to help the arts develop, especially now that there is this sort of big market boom? Do you see that there's due to some obsolescence of some other older institution like the museum you were talking about, what would be for you, according to you, the best project that could be happening in the city?
In terms of...
of agglomeration of like different arts or like fostering of a common discourse.
Well, I don't know, because I don't think I've begun to realize that I don't think that having this kind of connected network collective idea is in the nature of the city, especially now. Mm-hmm. It isn't in the nature of the city. It's more and more about individuals and individual spaces and smaller spaces. So. I don't particularly have much faith in institutions like suddenly coming out with. So I really don't know what would be an ideal kind of.
Like
it would have to be smaller initiatives, mm-hmm. several parallel spaces. I mean, essentially, when Experimenta started 4 years ago, it was one of the first film festivals, and ever since, there's tons of film clubs, there's a lot of film festivals, there's several parallel spaces, and it's extremely exciting on that level. A lot of these communities, again, not connected, but there are smaller initiatives, which until very recently there weren't, So I suppose, that's the way it will be, but at an institutional level, I don't really think there would be a way of kind of working through this, yeah.
We can perhaps open up to the floor if there's any question for the speakers. There's one question here in the front.
I just wanted to connect this last question that you raised to comparing the cities of Bombay and London. And it was striking that I think in the morning session, perhaps, when we were talking about what Bombay has now become, there was talk about the financial sector and the creative industries, mm-hmm. which is exactly what London has now become. And where what we see now happening in London is a recognition of the idea of creative industries, both from a public sector point of view. So, you have the government pumping money into recognizing this as a business sector and as an engine for growth. And so institutions like yours, so at the RCA, where the Curating Contemporary Art course was funded by the Arts Council to produce curators to fill up institutions like this. So I was wondering what's happening in Bombay
How is in the creative industries, beyond Bollywood, is that being thought about, discussed, recognized?
Well, I think so. I mean, in terms of within this similar kind of idea, I know the British Council has this creative industries kind of program that's happening across the country. So there's something happening there, and though I don't necessarily know what that means or how that's going to actually translate. Also, the organization that I'm now working with, which is the India Foundation for the Arts, we're actually trying to kind of start a curatorship program. So as in, we have kind of just had some early discussions with the curators of both film and visual arts. And the idea is to, we've kind of mapped this ideal world of curatorship in the country, but because there's been, there's so many individual curators, both in the galleries and in the smaller film festivals. So the idea is essentially to kind of start with, IFA is an independent body, so the idea is to kind of start with a small kind of research nodes to actually discuss what kind of curatorship one could have in a context where art education or the teaching of art history stops at a certain point, So how do you kind of bridge that gap between into contemporary art and actually therefore have curators who are also, well, critics and who are also people who are well informed of the history of art in such a kind of disparate context.
But you haven't addressed how that's to be funded, because I mean that's the core part of the linkage between, say, London, where right. The creative industries part of it is being funded, yes, by the government, but mostly by the art market.
I mean, even this, there is this, the Tata Fund that is interested in funding the curatorship program. And this creative industries thing is the British Council, so, yeah.
But the state isn't massively intervening in this scene at the moment, right?
No, the state is really not very involved.
Is there another question? Gentleman in the middle row.
Yeah, it's a question for Raoul. I was really, really interested in your paper, so thanks very much for that. And you mentioned this place which had an alternative sort of architecture that you thought might offer an alternative for how Bombay might develop. And I just wondered what other models of architecture might there be for Bombay other than either the slum or the skyscraper. Do you have any other experiences to share?
In fact, that argument really draws from Charles Correia's book, The New Landscape, published in 76, where he talks very clear. I mean, I think he also sort of indicates that European cities often can be better role models for Bombay than the kind of obsession with verticality, which really took on in Southeast Asia in a big way, modeled on Manhattan and Chicago. So his is a very clear-cut argument about, they are inexpensive, they often tend to sort of absorb more populations because of that, and he gives examples, and it's a very detailed study. So I have just taken it off straight from that. In fact, if you want to give the examples of the different kinds of models, there are, there are Wadis, which are really clusters of little homes around courtyards, and Bombay, in fact, had a huge variety of such forms. Of course, not all of them were, can be sort of used in the same manner. They have to be improvised on. But every architectural form builds on something. So I think there were enough things to build on and improve, but which somehow didn't take off, largely because of the way in which I feel the real estate market functions. The builder lobby is extremely, sort of, I would say, indiscriminate and rapacious in every sense.
We've got a time for a last question, just here in the row in front. So if you can just pass it, that's it.
We're here for the event called Mapping Mumbai, and I've noticed all the three of you still refer to Mumbai as Bombay. Very interesting. I just wonder how culturally and politically significant that might be. But just a very quick second strand is, what can we in London learn from you all in Bombay regarding using the arts and culture to mobilize social change?
Wow.
Right. Let's do it.
Yeah. Do you want to answer?
Well, there,
There's all kinds of ways. It depends on what you're interested in. For me, I'm interested, and this goes back to, I guess, a different question about what kinds of forms, or institutional forms and so on. I mean, I'm interested in certain kind of what are being called knowledge processes, right? I'm interested in the open exchange of information. I'm interested in people being able to build things. I'm interested in that kind of openness. What that means, basically, is that it's a kind of bottom-up cultural formation. I spent a lot of time in Silicon Valley recently, and it's very interesting. It's a kind of highly corporate model. Like, we see it now as a kind of corporate paradise, but 20 or 30 years ago, there were a bunch of people who built this entire culture in their garages, right? And so I have great respect for some of that, the depth of knowledge that it takes to build something like an operating system, for example, was built by like little, you know, young geeks in their garages. And they didn't have any institutions necessarily supporting them. And I'm not saying that's necessarily the best model for growth or for creating a diverse culture, but I'm looking at a process in which enough people are sharing information at the extremely at the ground level of, you know, of how things are done, how things are made, how things are built, how things are controlled, that then results in interesting formations higher up. So for me, if, you know, I'm working with three or four students or, you know, people, suddenly somebody becomes a famous artist, somebody becomes a curator. So these are things that come out of kind of groundwork without necessarily institutional frameworks for me. So I don't know. So I mean, there's a lot of ground in India. There's a lot of unexplored territory. And so, you know, that's inspirational in my case. I don't know if that answered your question, but it's a way of thinking. It's a way of understanding culture, not maybe from a cultural studies kind of point of view where it looks down upon the city or the map of the city, but if you're in the city and you're making little movements, then something grows out of it, and it's a kind of bottom-up thing. And I found that quite interesting and rather successful in many forms.
If I can just respond. I think for me, a very good conversation between London and Bombay can really be about the idea of the city itself as an ideological space. You know, I think we talk about urbanism as an inevitable force. I think Bombay in many ways sort of points out that it's not so. It is as much of an ideological force as many other similar ideologies where we simply imagine and presume that this is the inevitable way for the human future. Now, my understanding of Bombay says that, well, there's something wrong if this is the way we're going to visualize it. And not only me, I mean, any urban sociologist who talks about many third world cities, you know, Mike Davis talks about, you know, more than, you know, 70% of the world's population going to be living in habitats which are called slums in the next 15 to 20 years. But that is something which I think is worth sort of having a conversation about. And also to examine, you know, exactly at what point of time, because London itself, I think the history of London also reveals all kinds of very discontinuous, you know, sort of ways in which it became a metropolis. There were many questions. It was not a very smooth historical process. So that, I think, would be a very important way. Broadly framing the ideology, framing the experience of the city itself as much as an ideological force, something which we take for granted, and maybe we need to question that.
I'm afraid we have to draw this to a conclusion, but thank you very much to the three of you for your exceptional contribution, and thank you for coming.